And we are back with episode 261 of The Critical Myth. I'm John, your host, and tonight we have...
This is Gary from Jacksonville. I'd rather just stay in my home, but I have a feeling we're going to be going somewhere with this show today.
And this is Bronslum from Australia, and should I be concerned that it's getting very, very toasty where I am? I mean, I haven't heard anything sort of flapping around outside, but I'm a little worried.
All I know is that next time someone knocks on my door and tells me to go on an adventure, I'm going to say no. But anyhow, we are going to be talking about The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey. And before we get much further into it, I just want to remind everybody that we are going to talk about just about everything to do with this film. So there will definitely be spoilers, although this has been out in the theaters, and I don't know too many people that haven't had a chance to see it quite yet. As far as I'm concerned, if Bronslum has had the opportunity to see it, considering how late it came to Australia, I'm fairly sure everybody listening to this should have had an opportunity. But if you didn't, save it until after you have seen the film, although if you haven't seen the movie and you haven't read the book, you probably don't care. But at any rate, we are going to start off with, of course, as always, a little bit of a taste of the film, and this would be a short little clip. So here you go.
Expecting Hobbit to be a musical, but I really enjoyed the numbers. I got
recap
to see this
first, actually.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Anyway, we're talking about the first of three Hobbit movies, The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey. Bilbo Baggins, who is swept into an epic quest to reclaim the lost dwarf kingdom of Erebor from the fearsome dragon Smaug. Approached out of the blue by the wizard Gandalf the Grey, Bilbo finds himself joining a company of 13 dwarves led by the legendary warrior Thorin Oakenshield. Their journey will take them into the wild, through the treacherous land swarming with goblins, orcs, and deadly wargs, as well as a mysterious and sinister figure known only as the Necromancer. Although their goal lies to the east and the wastelands of the Lonely Mountain, first they must escape the goblin tunnels where Bilbo meets the creature that will change his life forever, Gollum. Here, alone with Gollum on the shores of an underground lake, the unassuming Bilbo Baggins not only discovers depths of ingenuity and courage that surprise even him, but he also gains possession of Gollum's precious ring that holds unexpected and useful qualities. A simple gold ring that is tied to the fate of all Middle-earth in ways Bilbo cannot begin to know.
And all without a pocket handkerchief.
Indeed.
Yes. I've come to the decision for these movies that I will not consider them the book. I think they take liberties as well as cut in ways that someone who faithfully loves this book, as many do, will be offended by. Not so much feel like they were ripped off, but just that it doesn't ring true and it's not what they grew up with. So much like many movie books gone to movies, I have to separate the two in my mind, and I'm going to look at this as just the film. That being said, the Lord of the Rings team or group, however you want to call them, have their visuals down perfectly. They are absolutely breathtaking to behold. It could almost be a nature series to just see some of these, some of the different mountain ranges as they're walking, or some of the large battles that occur with some of the goblins across the large grassy fields. It's absolutely beautiful and stunning, and regardless of what you think of the storyline or how it's changed, I think everyone will pretty much admit that it's a visually beautiful movie. That being said, also, I really enjoyed the focus and the extra time given to the fall of the Dwarf Kingdom. The visuals, as I'll no doubt say many times, were amazing. I thought they did a very good job giving us the background. While there was a fair amount of narration on it, at the same time, I felt the sense that I was in it, that it wasn't just words being read to me, how they had the actors acting and portraying things. I really felt into the scene, which is always good for a movie. Once again, everyone pretty much knows the story of how, you know, Gandalf gets, you know, sort of drags Bilbo into this. And I guess drags might be the right word, because I felt this movie did stretch out. And I realized that we already know it was pretty much a short book to begin with. But that aside, it did feel like this was stretched a bit. It could have been edited a little bit tighter. It was quite a long movie. I'm not sure the exact running time, but I know it was over 2.5 hours. And it didn't need to be. I think they could have tightened the story up a little bit and still had just as much impact and got across everything they needed to. It was good. It was a nice setup. I was very disappointed, as well as was my son, who while has never read the book, has had it read to him. And even my 11-year-old was let down. He's like, "What do you mean? they're stopping on the top of this mountain." It did make for a good stopping point to go to the next movie, but he felt ripped off. I felt ripped off, and it left me with a slight bit of a bad taste. I am looking forward to the next movie, but I felt like there should have been something more and not just left where it was.
It's interesting because kind of knowing going in that obviously they were going to have to stop somewhere, this felt like probably the most natural place for them to stop.
Oh, I feel it was.
I actually expected a cliffhanger. I thought that they could have stopped sort of in the middle of that big fight just before the eagle showed up. That's kind of what I was expecting.
That might have been a better stopping point. You're right. Because like I said, we just felt like, what?
No. The big what moment at the end for me, just so that we'll go back kind of backwards on this, I guess, was where Thorin and Bilbo have their little moment. That felt way too early in this whole process for Thorin to be that enthusiastically, you know, happy with Bilbo. I mean, I get the point, but whoa, that was like, that was fast.
It's one of the iffier moments of the thing, because kind of like you were saying, John, that's something that happened that kind of eventually happens way later in the story, and they've Peter Jackson and company, they've clearly moved it up to the end of this film so that there is a kind of conclusion to the character arcs that began in this one. My problem is not so much how it all came together as is, okay, what are they going to do next? I'm still certainly looking forward to the next one, but I am sort of curious about what they're going to do with the characters and the dynamics going forward now that they've sort of moved past a lot of the conflicts that have been brewing since the beginning of this particular story. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, to me, it seems, I think the next one is called The Desolation of Smaug. And so
that's correct.
That gives me a fairly... It gives me the feeling like they're going to actually tell the story through to the defeat of the dragon, which not too much of a spoiler if you've read the thing, okay? And then you're going to have, you know, as everyone kind of knows the story, that everything is great and everyone's getting along really, really well, and they get past their differences right up until the point that they finally get what they want, and then it all falls apart. And there is a rift between Thorin and Bilbo towards the end. And so I feel like this moment should have come sometime in the second film, so that in the third film it can break apart and they can have that regret. So that's my feeling for how they're going to kind of break it up. Because, you know, it's going to kind of roughly approximate the prequel trilogy of Star Wars, so the next film is going to be the love story between Bilbo and Thorin. And maybe Keeley, I'm not entirely sure.
No. Keely's got his own love interest.
Yes, it's going to be the story between Bilbo and Smaug, so that they can have the parallelism with Sherlock.
And
that's going to be Tumblr. Trust
thing,
me. It will.
Yeah. That's for about
don't
a year.
Don't make me take my headphones
Dragon,
off.
Now. Hobbit the Dragon get a flat in
that's
Rivendell.
Right.
It's all crime.
All right. Well, look. Story wise, obviously, Gary, you hit it right off the top. This is not the story that we know from the book. There's no way it could have been. They had to pad the hell out of this in order for it to be three films, and we know that. So, to me, I kind of had a little bit of a problem with the pacing. This did not need to be a three-hour film.
No.
It would have been perfectly fine at probably 2 hours, 15 minutes.
Yeah, 2:15 to 2:30, I think, would have done it. Yeah,
there were entire scenes that I was thinking could have been ripped right out of it, and you would never have noticed that they were gone. The one that really bugged me was the scene in the Misty Mountains. It felt like the most gratuitous, unnecessary action scene that was just CGI to the point where it was almost as bad as some of the stuff that you see on the Transformers films where you can't figure out what the hell's going on because it's just like, stuff winging here and this way and that. It's like, yes, the guy had in the book that there were giants in the mountains throwing rocks. You didn't need it to be like that.
No.
It felt so gratuitous. But then, you know, you've got this, the pacing is one thing because there were stretches where I was just, can we please just get on with this? And then there were the parts where you have this story that is obviously supposed to be more of a lighthearted, not entirely lighthearted because it is British after all, but, you know, more lighthearted story than The Lord of the Rings, which it was at the beginning.
Yeah.
And then you have this really odd attempt to try to kind of throw in some of the darker undertones that were present in Lord of the Rings throughout the story. And at times I felt that it really clashed. You know, everything that happens with Radagast is a really good example of that. Is Bronstump still there?
He's
yeah,
back.
Okay. Yeah, I thought I heard you drop out. But yeah, but to me, it was like Radagast is obviously played as something of a comical character.
He's a lot more lighthearted.
Yes.
Like, I don't see that character gelling well with in The Lord of the Rings, but The Hobbit is more lighthearted. It's a different tone, even though they do bring in some darker Lord of the Rings-ish elements and some of the characters who are a bit more serious than a kid's fantasy adventure would warrant. This is a lot more lighthearted. It's a lot more fun. I mean, the fact that you've got like a dozen dwarves running around, you know, being all blokey and bearded and stuff, there's a very boy's own adventure feel to it.
Well, yes, but I think my problem there was that Radagast is kind of, it fits the lighthearted part very well, but he is tied almost exclusively to the rise of Sauron as the necromancer. So, it's like, wait, he's connected to some of the darkest parts that are really the parts that were inserted into the story because they were all off page, yet he's probably the most kid-friendly part of the entire film.
Do you guys know the story about the quest for Erebor, which was the second book, the second Hobbit book that Tolkien wanted to write?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know, kind of knowing bits like that and being familiar with the appendix material, stuff like that, I didn't have as much of a problem with them swelling out the story a bit.
No. Don't get me wrong. I like the fact that they actually did show some of that because it's the kind of thing that I always wished that they would. I really would have liked those two kind of versions of the story to be put together. What was problematic for me was just the clash of the tones. Because, again, you had, like, this character that was kind of goofy, and then he was involved in the darkest parts of the story. So it didn't really fit. Meanwhile, you have Thorin and his, you know, band of dwarves, which at the very beginning were really very, you know, other than Thorin was kind of like the stick in the mud, but they were kind of lighthearted and everything else. But some of the best darker material was Thorin stuff. And that really fit the Lord of the Rings stuff very well. So to me, it was almost like the process of melding the various pieces of that history together didn't quite work as well as maybe it could have. And part of it was, again, like, okay, you know, Radagast sees all this stuff going on, and he's played very broadly, and then he goes running through the forest on a sleigh with big jackrabbits. And it's like, okay, I can see these two things working really, really well in two entirely different films, or at least with something in between them. But when you go from one to the other, it's like, whoa, this doesn't feel like the same universe at all. But I didn't necessarily mind them in isolation. It was just the clash of them right next to each other. And maybe I'm not really explaining it very well, but tonally there were a couple moments like that where I just thought to myself, that could have been done a little bit better. Just like with the pacing. It's like, wow, you really went along with that. If you edited it down, it actually would have worked better. You know, maybe on a director's cut where you're hanging out for the day watching The Hobbit, it wouldn't be so bad. But it's like, you know, if they had released some of the extended cuts of the Lord of the Rings movies, I think that it would have been deadly for a lot of the people who actually went and enjoyed it in the theater. There's a difference between the Tolkien geeks watching this stuff and then the general audience, but anyway.
Yeah, there's perhaps a bit, perhaps just a bit of difference.
Well, you mentioned the quest for Erebor. I believe that's in the Unfinished Tales, right?
Well, it's not just, I think what eventually came of the whole idea was just that bit in the Unfinished Tales where, and a lot of it is translated pretty directly into this film. It's basically the early events of The Hobbit from Gandalf's perspective. So it's not merely, I'm a fun wizard, I'm going to help Thorin on his merry adventure. It is, if I help Thorin do this, that's going to be crazy important in shifting the power balance that's going to prepare for this. All the kind of stuff they cover in the film. But Tolkien wanted to go back and write an entirely new novel version of The Hobbit in the style of Lord of the Rings. And he couldn't get it, and he couldn't get a publisher interested in it because Lord of the Rings, I mean, for all that we love it, was a bit more of a slow burner. The Hobbit did pretty well, but it was this fun adventure, and no one wanted to really kind of go back and, hey, we're going to do another version of this beloved book, but we're going to make it more serious.
Yeah, I think he actually had a pretty hard time convincing them to go back and do a revision in order to line it up more with the Gollum stuff in Lord of the Rings. Because he had to go back and fix some stuff because it didn't quite line up.
And it's why the whole chapter reads very different from the rest of the book.
Mm-hmm.
But it's so yeah, I guess going into it, I think even though I knew all this stuff about the I knew already about stuff that was going on and what Tolkien wanted to do with the things like that. I kind of expected, in the grand scheme of things, to have more of a Gary-like reaction to the film of being upset with how they decided to change and mangle with things, this beloved thing, because I love The Hobbits to bit. It's the first thing I ever read. It's just a very ingrained part of me and my geekitude and all that kind of stuff. And so I go in and I sit in the theater and they go this complete other direction from how the book started. I mean, we don't start with Bilbo meeting Gandalf, you know, with Gandalf meeting Bilbo. We start with, did it go the prologue and then the frame, or the frame and then the prologue?
The prologue and then the frame, I believe.
It all kind of, you know, went in that order and stuff like that. But to be honest, I just wound up being really, really riveted the whole way through. And I mean, I think back on it now and I can see some pacing problems and some things where I wish, okay, maybe that could have been tighter and stuff like that. But just in the cinema, I was really, really, really engaged because when it perhaps wasn't working 100% as its own film, I felt like it captured what I loved about the book. And what I love about, you know, all the Lord of the Rings elements and Middle Earth and all the Tolkien and stuff like that, it was just, it got it and it threw it up there on the screen, and I just really, really dug that. I've heard a lot of people complain about the fact that the unexpected party went on for ages and ages, but I could have watched them hang out for another hour, because just all the dwarves had such a brilliant dynamic, and Gandalf as the exasperated school teacher, constantly having to count them, like they're on a school excursion, and just the way that just the extreme culture shock between them and Bilbo, it was just I ate all that kind of that detail, that dynamic, that just I ate it up.
That could have been its own little movie just by itself. That interaction, you know, it was really enjoyable. You know, I didn't see a face in the movie theater that wasn't smiling from ear to ear as they were doing that whole plate juggling cleanup. It was really cool.
And you'd better believe that there have been just 80 gazillion Tumblr gifs of Bilbo just looking at the contract. Nope. All over.
Yeah.
We've all been there, I think.
Yeah. It's interesting because obviously there were, I don't know how recently the two of you might have seen the original animated version of The Hobbit. But
not for a long while.
No, it's been a significant amount of time, yeah.
With The Hobbit coming out, my kids actually had asked to see it again, probably about 2 weeks before we saw this film. So I had a lot of it kind of refreshed in my memory. And what I found really neat were how many scenes were, if not directly referential of the animated version, that they were very clearly homages to them. A lot of the stuff in the house, at the party, a lot of the scenes with Bilbo and Gollum, for instance, there were little visual touches that were very much homages to that.
I was going to say, you felt it was at a homage level, or did they rip it off?
I don't think they ripped it off, because unless you really kind of saw the beats of it, I don't think that it was that obvious. There were things that worked a lot better, because obviously in an animated film where they're pushing the story through as fast as humanly possible, there were things that were glossed over. But I think that there were things that were done better here, obviously, that worked, but there were little visual touches that I thought were definitely there to kind of remind you of that previous iconic film, especially when, you know, you've got Gollum sitting there screaming, Baggins, we hates it forever. I mean, it might as well have been, you know, a direct reference to that earlier thing, because it was the most intense part of the entire animated film. Everything else was kind of silly, but that at least had some intensity to it. I want to kind of talk a little bit about some of the things that I think didn't quite work in how they translated it, other than the pacing and some of the tonal stuff. The one thing that I thought was just really they were two, but they were related. The scene with the trolls, I thought, was a little much, because it didn't feel like that was all that consistent with what had happened in the Lord of the Rings films. And I'm making a distinction between what was clearly in the book, where the trolls were having that exact conversation for all intent purposes, versus the films that are there where they don't talk. I was sitting there thinking to myself as they were going, it's like, this is nice and all, but it doesn't really fit what we've seen. And I don't know, it almost felt like it would have been better if they didn't talk at all. It might have made it a little bit more of a consistent scene. What do you think, Gary?
Well, intentionally, they are putting, you know, several humorous moments into this film to attract, maybe a younger viewer or somebody who wants a lighter movie. And if they had to throw something in, I thought it worked okay. Yeah, it was a little hokey, and do I give them extra credit for it? No. But I mean, extra points is making it a good film. But as far as comedy relief, they could have done a lot worse, honestly. So I'll give it a pass. But it definitely wasn't a high point for me, the way that the party scene at Bilbo's was.
Yeah, how about you, Bronstone? What did you think of that particular part?
I don't know. Again, I'm sort of. I suppose that was a bit that tweaked a bit. I mean, I'm caught between fandom love for the whole film and a bit more critical eye. I don't know. It's just. Honestly, I guess it was one of the more noticeable bits where they zigzagged around how something happened in the book, and there was a bit of that whole thing of just, hey, I don't know none of the trolls in the other film. Like, I thought of it. There were very few times actually in the cinema where I kind of stopped and thought, even when I was enjoying it. But I don't know, the thing I kind of missed the most was Gandalf using a cantrip to defeat three trolls.
Mm.
Although it's sort of counterbalanced by the fact that this was really, it was a time for Bilbo to kind of start coming into his own and facilitate the whole thing. And it goes back to that thing of how they accelerated a lot of the character development that took place over the whole story. They compressed a lot of it into this first film. So Bilbo really kind of coming into his own in terms of what he's good at and what he can do within the party that none of the others can. And his dynamics with the rest of the dwarves and Thorin in particular. It was probably one of the most off bits. And mm-hmm. And I say off in a very vague way, because I really have trouble figuring out how I mean it. It was just where I kind of twigged to the fact that I was watching a movie that was going a bit off course of this book that I really, really love.
Mm. There was one other scene or thing that was, as I said, somewhat related to it that bugged me. When we've got this really nicely conceived villain of Azog, the you know, Thorin's nemesis, which does a nice job of personalizing the orcs and the connection to Moria and everything that we know is going to happen later in the story, which was kind of glossed over in the actual book. Then they get into the Goblin Lair, and you meet the Goblin King, and I swear I was thinking of the Gungan leader from Phantom Menace.
No, that was Brian Blessed! This was Dave Edna.
It doesn't matter. It still was like, I know why they're doing this, but it's exactly the same thought process that went into making the leader of the Gungans so goofy and silly. And it's to appeal to the younger audience, and I get that, but it's like, okay, this is just a step too far for me. It started to take me out of the story. Because it was like, all right, if he starts to do more of this farty, snotty thing, I'm really going to get annoyed. And it sounds to me like, Bronze Thumb, you kind of let that pass while you were watching it, but Gary, I'm kind of...
Yeah,
it's just, it's in some ways reminiscent of Lucas changing the Wookiee planet why am I blanking out on
Endor?
That?
Ewoks?
To Ewoks, yeah. You know, you do it for no real story purpose so much as to have a humorous moment put in that really doesn't affect anything one way or the other. And so are we just supposed to chuckle and move on, or are we saying, or do you say, why did you waste our time with this? And it's so I still have feelings. I can't say that it was a good move, or at least that I thought it was.
I mean, just those
they
things in particular,
worse,
you know, I understand they're trying to be like the lighthearted thing. But if they're going to start lacing some of these more serious things into it, as they have the council at Rivendell, that as the dwarves are, you know, basically just kind of glaring at everybody in the background and doing their own thing, you've got Gandalf and Saruman and Galadriel getting together and having this extremely, you know, important discussion about the, hey, why are you doing this? Well, because if this happens, then this happens, then this happens. You know, they're putting all of that in there, but at the same time, they're making intentional decisions to stray from the way that they've depicted these exact same creatures in the past in order to appeal to younger viewers, who most of which want to go because they've probably seen Lord of the Rings at this point. You don't really need to do that. And there was a reason why I was bringing up the Phantom Menace at that particular point, because there are unfortunately a lot of people that feel that this was not unlike that in terms of the expectations and the final result, although I would disagree with them on a matter of scale. But we'll get to that later, I suppose. I mean, the story-wise, I want to say, we're talking about a 3-hour film. We're maybe talking about some of the things that happened in roughly 15 minutes of that didn't really work for us. And I'm not even speaking for all of us when I say that. So obviously, the rest of it we don't really have a problem with, because these are the things that just kind of pop out as being the more obvious moments that didn't quite work as well. Now let's go on to the things that probably we are going to rave about, and that would be the cast. I would expect you guys to rave about the cast. You know, for somebody who had to be convinced to come back to it, Ian McKellen did a great job as Gandalf again.
Had to be convinced to come back?
Yep, he didn't want to come back.
Well, you know, not only did he do a good job, I guess this falls under doing a good job, but you got a sense that it was an earlier version of the character, that he wasn't quite so jaded and focused as he would be in the Lord of the Rings movies. You know, it didn't look so much like a younger version of him, but it sure felt like it. You sort of, you know, you felt that he was a younger, more optimistic sort of soul at that point, which was a nice conveyance. I wasn't sure whether they were going to actually try and make him look significantly younger in any way, and they really didn't. I mean, he pretty much looks the way he did through Rings, but it came across as, you know, how long was it? 80 years? 100 years?
60 years.
60 years. He came off as significantly younger than he did in the earlier movies. And so I thought he did a great job with that. The Bilbo character, I liked him as well. And even the dwarves, they were a little too slapstick for me, with the exception of Thorin. So that part didn't work for me quite as well. But I guess that's their purpose, in a sense, was mainly just sort of comedy relief.
Well, I always had the sense that the dwarves, because there were so many of them, that they were going to have to really look at them across the canvas of three films and have each of them have their moment along the way. Because in this film, really, you had Thorin, Keeley, and Balin, I think, were the three that had the most depth given to them. You definitely got the feeling of the relationship between Thorin and Balin.
Ofa?
Well, yeah.
Got a really good... I really hope I'm referring to the right one. The one played by James Nesbitt, who it seemed like they transferred a lot of what they did with Ori and Bilbo in the book, of the one who, the only one who really consistently looked out for Bilbo. Mm. They kind of transferred that to another character who had a good. But I don't know. Watching the film, I felt like with the dwarves, the two things that struck me was this band of dwarves felt way more ragtag than the one in the one in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Like I really, really got the sense that Thorin and a couple of the others were soldiers, and then the rest, these are like guys who had, until about a week ago, worked in a mine or in a factory or something, and then the boss says, "Hey, we're gonna go on an adventure and rescue our homeland from the dragon," and these are the guys who were just like enthusiastically, possibly even suicidally brave enough to go, just like, "Yep, let's do this."
Well, I think they actually said that in the movie, didn't they?
Yeah.
I mean, they said, these guys have been very seriously waiting for an opportunity to do it. These are the ones who were the only ones who answered the call.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think even Thorin said, you know, they're only, like, was it? It was himself and one other person are the only warriors, you know.
Yeah.
But it kind of helps with the big dynamic. You could get a bunch of people who, you know, crack fighters who I mean, what it winds up is it's a very different dynamic to the Fellowship.
Yeah.
The Fellowship is all, like, you know, the best of the best, and these guys are not.
Well, it's actually a fairly canny way to approach it, because in the book, yeah, you get the sense that these guys all have known each other for a while. In this particular version, they really don't. They know of each other, but they don't really know each other that well. And so, in a sense, we're kind of learning about them as they learn about each other. And
yeah,
maybe the hidden,
like,
things that, you know, the hidden, you know, qualities that they're going to show as you go. Like you said, Bombor is very much played for laughs at the beginning, because he's the one who eats everything and is kind of the big guy and the doofus. But he's showing this compassion for Bilbo almost from the start that the others don't, because, you know, maybe he has always been kind of dismissed over his lifetime. And he's looking at Bilbo and saying, yeah, but, you know, why are we going to do the same thing to this guy? You know, he's going to be probably the first one to warm up to Bilbo in that situation.
It's very much they're all getting the same character arc as Bilbo. He's not the only one who's kind of, and even though everyone else rocks up on his doorstep ready to go on this adventure, and Bilbo's the one who needs to be convinced, and there is some differentiation there. Once they get more and more into it, Bilbo, you know, you start to realize Bilbo's not the only one who's out of his element. He's just the only one who's not crazy enthusiastic about it.
Well, it's almost like that, you know, when you put it that way, that they're transferring some of what of their fears onto him to a certain extent, because how many of them, now that they've actually kind of got going on this, are having second thoughts as well? But they've got Thorin sitting there beating the drum going with his intensity, and he's like, if you know, they probably think if they don't go along, he's going to take that oak tree and beat the crap out of them to get in line. So. Which, by the way, for all the times that we've heard Thorin Oakenshield between the book and the various other incarnations, this is the first time I was actually convinced that this dude would be rocking an actual piece of oak.
Yeah, that was awesome.
He's like, yep, okay, I buy it.
I remember saying it when they first announced the casting. The immediately two super conflicting thoughts I had was that tall, dark, and brooding is not the qualities that you think of when you think of a dwarf. But at the same time, given Richard Armitage's body of work, Thorin Oakenshield is going to be the baddest MF-er in Middle-earth.
Yeah.
And I feel, oh yeah, oh yes he is.
I loved Armitage as Thorin.
He was great.
He was my favorite part of the Robin Hood show. And clearly, when he would show up in other things, it was always a fist pump moment because it's like, oh, this guy rocks.
He was a great, he was the lead in Spooks for about 3 years. He had a minor role in Captain America.
Yep. Yeah.
He just does a ton of stuff. So yeah, and just him yeah, he was awesome. And I feel like as much as the Hobbit really runs on this on this Trinity a lot more than and this very very centralized Trinity thing. Whereas Lord of the Rings, you had Frodo, you had Gandalf, you had Aragorn, and those are probably like the three protagonists, and they sort of echo it in the Hobbit, but in Lord of the Rings, they're all separated. They're off doing their own things all the time. In Hobbit, they all feel like they're together. There's a lot more dynamic between them in this film, at least, I guess. And Martin Freeman, I guess, like and Ian McKellen were kind of more the known quantities. Obviously, Ian McKellen did Lord of the Rings and was brilliant. And Martin Freeman, it's just the dude was born to play this character type, and he's done so many times and is so brilliant at it. I mean, like, you're Arthur Dent and John Watson and stuff like that. Like, the guy who is just, like, pretty ordinary until someone drop kicks him into the middle of an insane adventure. Mm-hmm. And, of course, he's the guy you're going to get for one of the for the most prestigious literary example of that character type. Like, there was no doubt going into this that Freeman would be anything other than awesome, and Armitage was kind of the question mark, but he more than holds his own.
Now, I would make a slight argument here that I think Armitage actually buries himself into the Thorin role better than Freeman does into Bilbo.
I do agree with you. You can see a lot of the Martin Freeman, the touches that he tends to bring to a lot of the things, just the way he delivers a lot of lines, that slightly awkward, uncomfortableness sort of thing, but I think it just totally works for Bilbo, whereas Armitage, yeah, it's a lot more of a transformation.
For me, it's more along the lines of when I was watching it, at least initially, before I kind of recalibrated my head, my thought was, hey, look, it's Thorin. Oh, yeah, that's Richard Armitage. And it was like, okay, I really appreciate how well he's doing Thorin. For Bilbo, it was like, hey, look, it's Martin Freeman. He's playing Bilbo. There, yeah, he did another Freemanism. Oh, and another one. Okay. And then, like, eventually I stopped seeing that, but it's like you said, he has very, very recognizable line deliveries, facial tics, hand gestures that you kind of got to get
past. As my son said, hey, Dad, does he have a towel?
Yeah, but you get what I mean, is that when you know him as an actor and you've seen him a lot, it almost becomes, I hate to bring this up because I know it has a lot of negative comments. It's almost like the Tom Cruise thing, or even like a Kevin Costner thing, where you recognize the actor so well that you have to kind of get past that before you can accept the character.
See, I didn't have that problem. I did see the Freemanisms, but I think they were just so well suited to this character that I was on board with him as Bilbo in no time at all.
I hear you. How about you, Gary? What are your thoughts on these? Because we've been kind of going on for a little while.
No, that's fine. You know, everybody's got their points of passion about this, because it's that type of movie that it seems to polarize a lot of people. But while I did recognize the actor, I have to say that most of the storyline was enough for me to not see him as the actor and see him as the character, particularly the golem scenes in the cave just had me completely immersed. So I really didn't see that. But for the first 10 to 15 minutes, I certainly did. It took me a while to, suspend that disbelief. Where with Armitage, I didn't have that. I instantly latched onto him. I didn't have any issue, seeing the character.
You know what I think actually probably did Freeman a little bit of a disservice here and caused that more than it needed to be, was having that framing device, which was nice and all, but I think was kind of unnecessary. But to have then Ian Holm version of Bilbo and remembering and thereby putting that in your head, and then going from that to Freeman's Bilbo, while you can see that there one is the evolution of the other, there is a clash in the acting style there. It's not like Freeman's tried to incorporate things that Holm had did as Bilbo into his performance. at least it wasn't obvious to me. So I think that those clashed, and so the Freemanisms kind of, that's going to become a term, isn't it? But that kind of threw out, it was right there in front of me. It was like, okay, wow, that's very different. That's very different from what, you know, we're used to. So it'll just take a little while. And it was like, so for, like you said, the first 10, 15 minutes, it was like, okay, yeah, I have to get used to him playing that role. But once I got used to it, and as you said, Bronston, the fact that he is really, this is his character type, he has this down, made it a lot easier. If it was someone that was, like, this was not a character that they usually play, but they can't play anything else kind of an actor, oh, it would have been an exercise in futility. But, I mean, the fact that he is really built for this kind of character made it a lot easier and a lot more palatable, because, never mind the fact that I just enjoy Martin Freeman in general. I mean, come on, Sherlock, Hitchhiker's Guide. I mean, we can go on and on. And these are the ones that probably people know best here. But certainly, I mean, go back to the original Office. I mean, you know, he has that DNA. He has that character beat down. So, yeah, definitely. I think that it was a good casting decision. I just feel like for us, maybe, the uber geeks that were watching it, it was like, boy, I see a lot of his things, his particular acting choices, like, really pop out. But no, I mean, overall, the cast was excellent. I can't complain. Mm. I think the thing that was weirdest was trying to convince myself that Elijah Wood was actually playing Frodo again. everything else felt pretty good. It's going to be very strange to me to have all these other people that are logically part of the story, and unless they have completely hidden it from any type of news outlet, not having Aragorn at all. Because he is actually supposed to kind of be involved later down the line.
The timeline of the films and the books is different because the films skip over a big gap.
Yeah.
True. To be more specific, in The Lord of the Rings, in the books, there was a gap of I think like 10, 15 years between when Bilbo left and Frodo left. And they skip over that in the films. It's a much shorter thing like that. So it's something like about 80 years between the events of The Hobbit and the bulk of The Lord of the Rings. In The Hobbit, in the books, Aragorn would have been a tiny, tiny baby at the time when they were doing this. So he would have been at Rivendell, although they wouldn't have got Viggo Mortensen. In the way that the book timeline, the way the film timeline lines up with the stuff that they talked about in previous films and sort of generalities about his timeline, he would have been old enough to just have left Rivendell and gone off on his own.
See, to me, it would make sense for him to be there at the inevitable. Okay, just kind of speculation here. The stuff that's going on with the Necromancer can't be too big, because it can't be so big that everybody doesn't have an issue with the idea that Sauron is kind of gathering his forces and everything else and looking for the ring and all that.
It can't dwarf what happened in Lord of the Rings, and it can't dwarf the Battle of Five Armies, because that still has to be the climax of The Hobbit.
Right. So to me, it's like what it has to kind of come down to is that all these people that before were not convinced that Gandalf was right, that something big was going on, they're all going to have to come to the conclusion that, no, we need to actually take this seriously now. Because that is where they were supposed to be at that point, because then they commissioned Aragorn to hunt down Gollum and all of that in the time in between. So, to me, it would make sense that he would show up as this, you know, young guy, probably not Viggo Mortensen then, but you get my drift, that he would be there because that would be the start of his journey. That would kind of be the connective thread. I can understand why they wouldn't do it, like you said, but the fact that they then played with the timeline and actually kind of shortened things up a bit does kind of make it actually more likely that he should be there. But whatever the case, I do like the fact that they are acknowledging that Legolas should be there. You know, you've got all these references to the various dwarf families, so...
Just very briefly on the subject of Legolas, can we all take a moment to appreciate the fact that Legolas is the punky tomboy of the family?
Yeah.
Fabulous Tendril is fabulous.
Yes. He's also really good at making pies, from what I understand, but that's beside the point. Anyhow, yeah, I think that this was a fine film. I would probably give it an 8. personally. I think that it had it could have been better than that, but I think it had some pacing issues. I can only imagine what it's going to be like if there's a longer director's cut.
There will be a longer director's cut. There will be an extended edition.
Yes, the extended edition will literally be a real-time edition where you're watching it all as it happens. But anyway, no, it was just a little overlong for me. But otherwise, it probably helped a little bit that I had heard so many negative things about it before I went in, so my expectations were slightly tempered. But I think that it was still very good. I certainly don't understand the people that are complaining about the CGI. I mean, there were a few moments that were way more CGI than a lot of stuff we saw in Lord of the Rings, but I think that people are also discounting just how much was CGI in Lord of the Rings.
Which frame rate did you see?
I'm pretty sure I saw the normal one, 24, because I saw the 2D version, and I don't think that they were running at the higher frame rate.
Yeah, most of the people who complained about the CGI, or at least most of the complaints that I've heard, it folds in with the 48 frames per second thing, and just the fact that the way the new frame rate is, like, it's such a visually different experience that the difference between live action and CGI is really obvious.
Okay, I get it. It's so new that the people who are doing the effects haven't accounted for that yet. So
Between standard definition and high definition.
Right. And what worked as CGI for standard definition looks really crappy.
Apparently doesn't necessarily work as well in...
They say what the big difference is that there's no motion blur when you run it at that faster speed. So just like you would see somebody run on a traditional movie, it blur out a little bit. It doesn't happen with the higher frame rate.
Mm.
So you sort of don't have that excuse as as a wraith is, you know, moving through something, or the necromancer's, you know, ghosts were swooshing. You still see them clear. There's no motion, you know, no like flash effect, I guess, for lack of a better term.
Okay, so it's like watching NFL football with with CGI around it.
Yes.
Okay. Gotcha.
Like the little lines on the field.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. You can kind of tell are not quite superimposed correctly. Gotcha. No. We saw the 24 frames per second version. It looked like the Lord of the Rings. There were just a couple moments that you could tell that they skimped and made it CGI instead of doing like a practical effect type of thing. But it wasn't that bad that it was like, oh, how dare they do this or anything like that. There was like one scene, I think, that we talked about when we got out of the movie theater where it was like, yeah, that was a little bit off, but I think it might have even been the Goblin King. And it might have just been because the performance was so goofy that it just made it all the flaws come out. But that could have just been us. But no, the people that are like, oh, this was terrible, it looked like trash, it was horrible, this was, you know, no, I don't get it. I mean, there were people that were complaining that he made a reference to indoor plumbing in The Hobbit Hole. I was like, why? Did you see any outhouses in the establishing shots? I mean, come on. Is that going to really be something that we complain about? But yeah, I mean, there were people that nitpicked the hell out of these things. And to me, it didn't really deserve that. It wasn't a Phantom Menace type situation, as much as some people wanted to make it out to be. I enjoyed it. I thought it was an 8. How about you, Gary?
I've been waffling between a 7 and 8 because, as I said, the pacing, where they chose to end the movie, even some of the humor that felt shoehorned in, left a sort of a bad taste in my mouth. So I'm going to go with a 7. When I give that, that's probably the most recommended 7 that I do give. Though it was a great movie to go see, I just felt it did have a lot of flaws.
How about you, Brunstam? Uh-oh, did we lose him? Oh, no, okay.
No, I'm here. I would go higher. I would go a 9. I was loving it.
I think you've gone native. Did you catch a flight over?
That's it. He's too close to New Zealand.
Exactly. I vote we discount that.
Okay, no, I'm Australian. I'm the most likely to jump on board the anti-New Zealand bandwagon.
That's true.
And vice versa. Just watch that episode of Flight of the Conchords.
I'm well aware, but go ahead.
I just enjoyed the thing from top to tail. I had such a good experience seeing this. I can't wait to go and see it again. And, you know, get more of those fun dynamics and great characters and performances and just how gorgeous New Zealand looks, and revisiting all these characters from the first one and meeting all these new ones, and just I was just so I just had a ball with the film. I loved it.
It's weird because my first thought upon kind of trying to think of where I was going to rank this, and maybe the reason that I gave it an 8, is that I was thinking that my reaction when all is said and done is going to be very similar to how I thought about the Lord of the Rings trilogy, and that the first one, when I got out of the first one, I thought, wow, this is great. This is perfect. This is exactly what I was looking for. And then when I saw the other two films, now I look back on it, and to me, the first film is actually the weakest of the three. You can see kind of the seams while they were still trying to figure out how to do things in that longer period of time to kind of revisit what they had already shot and kind of re-edit things and do things with the second and third film. That actually worked really well, especially for the second film. I actually think that The Two Towers is the best of the three films, and that The Return of the King, unfortunately, has that kind of like end of trilogy problem that, to use the Star Wars reference again, it actually reminds me a little bit of some of the issues with Return of the Jedi. But I'm wondering if we're going to have a similar thing here where right now, you know, we're really looking at this going, yeah, this is great. This is great. But then there's still the two to come. And when I look at what material has to be in the second and third films, I'm really looking forward to those. And I feel like those have more of a potential to align with what we've seen in things in Lord of the Rings, just knowing what they go through with Mirkwood, what they're going to have to do in terms of the Elven Kingdom, everything that's going to happen at Erebor. I'm really looking forward to that in the next film. And then the Battle of Five Armies, which was just this kind of very glossed over thing in the book, how they're going to handle that in conjunction with everything with the Necromancer, which was this complete side story in the appendix and everything else. To me, I'm really stoked to see if this is where they start. I want to see how they finish it. But I still feel like we're going to come back to this and still feel like this is the weakest of the three.
I'm curious, too, how this is all going to lay out as they go on. I can see points where they could break them. But yeah, as we're complaining that the pacing on this one was off, I could only see it getting worse in the next two movies. Because they covered, I guess they didn't cover a tremendous amount, but they stretched it out so much. If they're going to stretch out the rest across two more almost three-hour movies,
But the further that you get into the story, the more the stuff that's going on in the background with Gandalf becomes parallel to it. So I feel like there's more that they can put into it, which is why when they look at it, they go, you know what, we can either rush it in one more film or we can break it up and kind of be somewhat self-indulgent in the process. Because the weird thing is that we know this because it's been very public. This cut was not we're in a trilogy cut. This was the version that's in the There Are Two Movies cut.
I could see two movies. It's the third one that I start
right,
to
so they're
have
taking
it,
but what the second movie was going to be and effectively breaking that into two films. So, but at the same time, when I look at what needs to be covered and I see the pace of this film, I go, okay, I can see them only getting as far as defeating Smaug in the next film. And then having the third film be the, oh, now what situation, which then all of the aftermath of that, the Battle of Five Armies, all that happens with, but then they have to also take that and tie it into the state of play at the beginning of The Lord of the Rings, because that was one of their stated intentions anyway. So I think there is plenty to do. But as I said, I feel like, just like Fellowship of the Ring was an incredibly straightforward plot, I feel like this was the most straightforward part of this story. And for that reason, too, it's going to wind up feeling like the weakest of the three movies. Plus, it's the first one, so they had the least amount of time to do any type of post-production tweaking to it. You know, in the next two films, they're going to have the benefit of the audience reaction to it. And they're still, you know, filming stuff for the third film, so for all we know, they could go, hey, you know, while we're doing this, we're going to redo this thing over here. But anyway, that's just my take on it. I do think it's funny, though, that there are people that are treating the Hobbit films as the analog to the Star Wars prequels.
Oh, yeah, that's...
Like, you know, no, because it came so many years after the fact.
The source...
and it's, yeah, the timing.
Well, the source material was around...
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Just...
But, you know, it's when I look at it and I'm like, yeah, the parallels are probably there because Lucas cribbed big time from Lord of the Rings. Not because they're falling into the same pattern, but... And then there are people who think that, the Hobbit is something that they just kind of made up as they went along. As a prequel, just to make money off of the whole thing. So, Which is the kind of reaction that I think we all just kind of grit our teeth and want to punch somebody when they say stuff like that. So final thoughts on this, you know, something maybe we didn't talk about yet. Bronstom, how about you?
I don't know. I really want to see it again. It's just I think I covered it all in saying that I just love this movie to bits.
Okay. And Gary, how about you?
Once again, the portrayal of the fall of the Dwarf Kingdom was just was amazingly well done. You got the sense of pride from Thorin's grandfather, I believe it was.
Yes.
And you just saw how it all went wrong right in front of your eyes. I thought they did a very good job of portraying that on the screen.
Yeah, I loved all the stuff with the Dwarven Kingdom. I could have probably watched an entire film just about that story. Everything that happened by the Gates of Moria, I loved that reference because it took me back to everything that happened in the Lord of the Rings films, because that to me felt like an incredibly strong connection between those two. The resonance was really good. But props to them for including references to the Arkenstone. That's an obscure little thing from the appendices. But making sense of it was pretty nice.
Okay, that's pretty damn important to the last chunk of the story.
Yeah, it is, but it's completely missing from The Hobbit. I mean, certainly it wasn't nearly as prominently discussed as it was in the films. But at any rate,
okay, no, fair enough. They go into the backstory a bit, but yeah, I mean, the half the plot movements leading up to the Battle of the Five Armies kind of hinge on the Arkenstone.
Yeah, but I just like the way they wove it into it. That's all.
Mm. Yeah, no, it was done well.
Okay, well, there it is. Our thoughts on The Hobbit. We'll be having our second and third podcasts about The Hobbit later this... No, anyway, no, this will be it. We did our hour. We'll leave it there. Thank you, gentlemen, for all your help for this episode. And definitely, if you want to give us some comments, you can follow us on Twitter at Critical Myth, or you can go and like our page on Facebook. Again, that's Critical Myth.
You can give us feedback by visiting the website over at www.criticalmyth.com. Just check out the entries for the show and leave us a comment. If you can't find it, just go all the way up to the top of the page. There's a link there, and there's also a drop-down box for all of the shows we talk about. So please let us know what you think.
Or you can go over to the VOG Network page and go over to the forums, and we have a dedicated forum for this show. You can leave comments there for us.
You can also email your feedback to feedback@criticalmyth.com, or you can leave us a review on iTunes.
Or you can call our Google voicemail line at 908-977-MYTH. That's 908-977-6984.
And don't forget that Critical Myth's use of any and all copyright material is only intended for parody, news analysis, critique, or for educational purposes, as provided within United States Code Title 17, also known as the Fair Use Act. Please don't sue us.
And the comments and opinions of the Critical Myth podcasters and reviewers are not necessarily those of its distributors, partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. So until next time...